Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday and Sunday right here on KTEP. And joining us today is Dr. Rona Epstein. Dr. Epstein is a licensed psychologist, certified addictions counselor, and marriage and family therapist who has personally experienced recovery from food addiction, and she is the author of the recent book, Food Triggers, End Your Cravings and Eat Well and Live Better. Dr. Epstein, Rona, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Hi, Louie. It's great to be here.
You know, a lot of people talk about food and food addictions, but a lot of times when we think of food, we don't think of addictions. We think of addictions with drugs, with alcohol, cigarettes.
Yes, well, that's true. I think we joke about being addicted to those chips or that candy's addictive, and we joke about it. But actually, for some people, it's really deadly, and it's really just as bad as substance abuse problems for some people.
Well, here on the border, we have a high incidence, and I'm sure the United States is the same, of diabetes. And as we know, statistics show that approximately 74% to 75% of American adults are overweight, and
Yes. Almost
40% of those qualifying as obese. What is obese technically?
They're talking about numbers and BMIs, and not being a medical doctor, I work with people who have problems with overeating that are all sizes. Some are significantly obese. I have clients that are 400 pounds and can't walk up the steps. And I have clients who are not even overweight, but they're completely obsessed with food. So when we're talking about food addiction, we're not necessarily talking about obesity. And obesity really has to do with numbers, BMIs, you know, it has to do with being over a certain percentage of body fat.
And as you mentioned, you're not a medical doctor, but the fact that some people are overweight because they can't help it, they have thyroid problems or other situations like that. But then there are those who just love to eat or eat out of depression, out of anxiety.
Right.
And you mentioned, especially this time of year, because it's summer, people want to get ready for the pool, the beach, so they want to start losing weight. And then one of the biggest resolutions, as you know, New Year's is losing weight. They go out and buy the treadmill. 2 months later, it's a clothes rack.
Yeah, if they made it to 2 months.
Yeah, if they made it, exactly. And you mentioned that approximately Americans spend about $33 billion a year on weight loss products.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, I don't know in your neck of the woods, but here in the Philadelphia area, it is an obsession. People just are trying to fix their weight problems. Everybody's unhappy about their weight. And they're preoccupied. Even if you turn on the TV, you see all the commercials for these diet programs, and everybody's looking for their magic cure. Take this pill, and your weight will magically come off, or sign up for this gym. And really what we're doing is we're trying to fix the consequences of our overeating. We're not really dealing with the eating problem. We're dealing with the weight problem. We want to fix the weight, but we don't want to fix our eating problems.
Rona, we know a lot of people, we have different body types. And some people are just never going to be skinny or thin. Some people are just stocky. They are pear-shaped.
Yes.
So some people, just no matter how hard they try, they're always going to be a certain build. But that doesn't mean that they have to be overweight.
Right, of course. We're just all shaped differently. Yeah. And some of what we need to do is learn how to love ourselves where we are, because some things you can't fix. believe me, people are trying to fix things that they really can't. You can't really tamper with nature. I mean, some of it is you are what you are.
You talk about wiring in your book, that the spotlight should fall on wiring. Could you explain that for us?
Yes. One of the things that they have found, and you can see this with the history in alcoholic families, usually when I used to work with substance abusers completely. That's what I did in my early career. And you almost never meet an alcoholic who didn't come from an alcoholic family. There's usually addiction in the family of people who are struggling with substance abuse problems. Same thing with overeating. When I take a family history, we find that a lot of people have come from a family, and of course, we don't really know for sure nature, nurture, but there seems to be a difference, and you can see it in the brain. If you look at pictures of a person's brain, there are some people where their brain lights up differently than other people when they see certain foods. So for example, they did a study where they did some tests on people to see are they addicted to food, and then so they answered this Yale food addiction scale, and then they showed all of the people whether they were actually came out strong in the food addiction scale or whether they came out as not having a food addiction. And then they were showing images of milkshakes, and the brains of the food addicts lit up completely different. There's a totally different reaction, and it's very similar to substance abuse. You see changes in the brain that have to do with the pleasure centers in the brain and the dopamine and serotonin system, where, you know, a normal person can eat one cookie or two at the end of their meal and just be very satisfied, where for a food addict, they're not satisfied, and there is something kind of broken in their body, and it's both in the brain and also in their hormones, and you can, there's different changes that have taken place. And, you know, I don't know, anybody knows for sure, like I said, if it's nature or nurture, but there is definitely a chemistry involved that is beyond just emotions and psychological and willpower. You know, we're calling it willpower, but these are, for some people, these are addictive drugs. Some people can drink a glass of wine and they're good, and another person, once they start drinking, they can't stop. And it's the same thing for people who lose control of food. There's just some people who a little bit of sugar is going to trip that wire, and they're off to the races, even though they didn't mean to.
So you've talked a little bit about this food addiction. What is food addiction, and how can someone see the signs that they're addicted to food or addicted to a certain type of eating? So what are the signs of food addiction, and what is food addiction specifically?
Well, I think when we're talking about food addiction, there are diagnoses like binge eating disorder or bulimia. They have symptoms that are similar, where there's a loss of control. I mean, actually, if you look at the diagnostic criteria for substance abuse, there's the same pattern. It's eating more than you planned, eating when you're not hungry, eating to numb your feelings, to escape from stress, eating, you know, to beyond, you know, being full and just continuing to go, having negative consequences. You know, I have clients who their bodies are broken and they still keep eating, like you said, diabetes. I mean, when a person has diabetes and they keep eating high amounts of sugary foods, they can become very ill. And people who are losing parts of their bodies because of the diabetes and not having the sugar under control, and they're losing their toes and they're losing their feet, and they are in having high blood pressure. I mean, you know, and then emotional consequences, relational, you know, people are ashamed of their bodies, and now if they're not having sex with their partners, or they're isolating themselves and hiding and sneaking because they're ashamed of what they're doing, and now their life is really being wrecked by this problem. And, you know, then you know you have, I mean, when it's causing problems and ruining your life, then you know that we're past having a little fun with food. Now we have a problem.
A couple of weeks ago, our pastor at church talked about comfort foods. And we've heard a lot of people say, well, my comfort food is popcorn or chips. What about the use of food as comfort? Is that the same as an addiction?
Well, I don't think it's the same. I think it's a continuum. I mean, if a person uses food for comfort in an excessive way where it's causing damage in their lives, that's very different than when a person's using food because they're stressed out and they just want to grab something to eat to calm. It's just like a drink. I mean, somebody's stressed out, they come home, they have a glass of wine. I mean, in each person's heart, I think it's their, you know, is this something that's addictive or abusive? I mean, when you're talking spiritually speaking, you know, if a person feels convicted about it, then it might be something to look at, just in terms of a, you know, why am I using this? Am I drugging myself? Or, you know, am I just, is it okay? I mean, I think for each person, that's their own decision. But I think a little comfort is fine. It's just if a person's an addict, they can't do that. So So, you know, a person who wants one bite will lead to more and more and more. That person will need to find their comfort in some other way.
The latest magic word or words, I guess, are organic and sugar-free. Is that something that is going to make the person feel like, well, it's okay?
If it's organic and sugar-free?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I think organic food is, I think the goal that we want to get to when, if to get to be healthy, is to eat healthy food and nourishing food so that your body has what it needs and not to eat unhealthy food. Sugar is the biggest culprit in food addiction. It's the one that causes cravings and blood sugar drops, and even just, you know, small amounts of sugar and refined carbohydrates can, you know, really are, they're trouble. There's nothing healthy about them. They taste good, but they're not good for you. And, you know, organic foods, I mean, obviously you can go into a health food store and find organic foods that are full of sugar or full of other sorts of things. Just because they don't have chemicals doesn't mean it's necessarily a good food for you to eat if you're trying to calm down an addictive process. It really depends, like, how a person's using it. You know, if you have a chip problem and the chips are organic and you eat down a whole bag of chips, you're in trouble. Just because they were healthy chips, or, you know, doesn't make it a good thing.
Yeah, right. A lot of people say, well, you don't understand, you haven't been through it, but you have been through it. And yeah. You write in your book that, I guess, since the age of about 17, you started dealing with complications with food, with binging, yeah, everything emotionally, physically, and something like that. Would you care to share that with us?
Yeah, sure. Actually, when I was 17, I was already ready for help. I think I was one of those people who was wired for this problem, and I came from a family where it's a huge problem. So if you look at my family history, you see most of the women on my mother's side of the family have compulsive eating issues and a preoccupation with weight and food. And, you know, we always had excessive amounts of sugar and treats in the house. And I was always wanting, really, if you can come out of the womb looking for ice cream, that would be me. I just always wanted more sweets. I was hiding, sneaking from the time I was really young. And by the time I was 17, I was fully and completely out of control, binging every day, throwing up my food to try to control my weight, taking amphetamines to try to control my appetite. I was exercising crazy amounts, running 5 miles, swimming 2 miles, sitting in a sauna with a sweatsuit on, and then eating half gallons of ice cream, boxes of cookies, jars of peanut butter, and it took over my life. So I would, like, every day make promises to myself, like, today I'm going to stop and I'm going to follow my diet. And of course, my diets were ridiculous, starvation diet, where there wasn't enough food to live on. And then I would try to starve all day, exercise, and then go home and binge. And it really took a toll on me. And I ended up not being able to keep my weight off. You know how an alcoholic, they say you start out drinking on the weekends, and then it becomes a week all week, and then, you know, in the morning. And then that's what it was for me. Like, my control attempts failed. And it was so demoralizing and so devastating that I actually got to the point where I really wished that I was dead. And then I was very, very fortunate enough to find help. And so for me, you know, the help was, I found people. It was not another diet. It was not another diet. It was not another magical cure. It was a change that was body, mind, and spirit. It was recognizing that I have an addiction, mostly to sugar, and that I need to abstain from sugar if I'm going to keep myself from abusing food. And so I've been free from eating sugar for 31 years now. And I just don't eat it at all. To me, it's like a heroin addict using heroin once in a while. I don't eat it. And so from a body perspective, I needed to learn to eat healthy and to avoid addictive foods. And then, you know, there was a whole other aspect of changing, like you said, about comfort. I needed to learn how to get comfort and handle emotions and stresses and the challenges of life in healthier ways. So, you know, learning how to manage anxiety without food, or learning how to manage relational conflicts or disappointments and stresses without food could not be an option. It couldn't be a way of coping. It just had to be that I had to learn a whole new way of living. And as you say, in the last part was just spiritual, is finding faith and hope as a vehicle for believing that, you know, that I could do what I couldn't on my own with help.
You know, you said you started when you were a teenager, and we hear and see a lot of stories, and even on television, even the Leave It to Beaver show, Larry Mondello is a chubby kid, and there are always chubby kids in school who have a problem, and we know that kids can be very cruel to each other, and especially in middle school, and this, in addition to being overweight, and they're making fun of you, they're bullying you, then the child has a different problem now.
Yes, you are right. And actually, that's one of the things when I work with clients who are struggling with obesity, and they had it since they were children, the emotional scars from bullying are like, it breaks my heart sitting with people who have, even by their own parents and their own siblings, have been shredded emotionally by people who have been heartless. The stories that I've heard in my office are unbearable to listen to. People can be so mean and just insensitive. And so, yes, the wounds can be very deep, and that can take quite a bit of work to get through in therapy, to be able to find that, you know, to believe that you are valuable and special and beautiful and worth, you know, getting better. And, you know, because a person really can be pretty beat up, and there's a lot of pain and anger and fear of trusting people that comes from that.
Well, you just said it yourself. You're beautiful, you're a certain way, and people criticize themselves because they're too fat, too tall, too short. And your book has a lot of spirituality in it. It's based on Bible principles. And in Job 10:10, it talks about how God formed us, and he put the skin and the bones on us, and he made us a certain way. And so that if we question his wisdom and the way we're made, we're questioning what he's doing.
Right. That's right. It's a great verse to help a person who's struggling, that in Psalm 139, where, you know, it's a really good place to start for healing. And to just even begin to contemplate that could really be helpful to somebody who is feeling very broken.
Now, some people may say, okay, this book has some biblical principles in it and it's spiritual, so I don't go to church that much, or I don't believe in God, so this book's really not going to help me. What would you say to them?
Well, yes, the book does have a biblical base. I've had a lot of people who have read the book who are not believers necessarily, but they have found there to be hope in the principles that are in the book anyway. First of all, to understand the issue of addictive eating, the body issues, the emotional issues, but also the spirituality, you know, a person can kind of, I guess, take what they like from it, or what they can glean from it. And if a person doesn't believe in the Bible, you know, they can take what's there, and there's truth there, there's hope there, there's inspiration, and I believe that anyone could benefit from that.
The Bible talks about how our bodies are the temple of the Lord, and sometimes a lot of Christians, you see, are obese, they're overweight, including the pastors, and
yes,
some people are judging and say, well, wait a minute, these guys are supposed to be the examples, and look at the way they mistreat their bodies.
Yeah, it's sort of like one of those things that I guess gluttony must be the sin that we blink when we're reading the list of things that we're not supposed to do. You know, we just must blink and miss that one. You know, it is a curious thing that people are ignoring that. And it's, you know, in my opinion, and one of the things that was important for me as I was coming around to trying to let go of the excess food, is to look at the reality that in some ways that every time that I would choose to rather eat for comfort than to turn to God, that it's a form of idolatry. Like, why do I think that the answer to my life problems is in the cupboard or the refrigerator? When God is giving me a whole rich arena of things that are for me to, you know, his word and you know, counsel and people and all kinds of ways to that we can overcome the challenges that we have, to use the supports and the love that he provides and that people that are there for us provide. And yet we turn to food. And so we're missing it there. We are missing it.
What would you tell people who are listening and they'll say, I've bought tons of diet books or books about how to lose weight. I've tried every diet available and nothing seems to work. What makes your book different than all the others? Because some books make me so upset that I feel like even eating the book.
Well, you know, in this book, first of all, I think what most people find is that because I come at this from a very sensitive place, having been there, that there's this feeling of being like that. What I get from people, I've had phone calls from people all over who have read the book, and a lot, they're like, you get me. And you totally get me. I read your book and you get me. I felt like you were speaking right to me. And I think that when people feel understood, people who are in this battle and they feel, and everyone's throwing at them, like they say, why don't you just cut down? Or why don't you just stop eating? Or why don't you just do a little exercise and eat less food? And people just don't feel understood. And I think in this book, people find that they're understood, that there's a sensitivity about it, and then there's hope, and we understand now that it's not just another diet. It's a physical, emotional, and spiritual approach, and it really kind of covers the whole gamut, and we're not just trying to throw another, even though there are tips on how to eat without being addictive about food, the other parts, I think, balance it out to make this a really hopeful experience. And I say when people, the feedback I've gotten from people who really have a problem, it has been amazing.
You talk also about 12 steps in the book. Are those the steps used in AA?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I believe that those same 12 steps can be used to overcome a food addiction in the same way, except for you just change the word alcohol to food. And there are 12-step programs that are available all across the country for people who are struggling with overeating, like Overeaters Anonymous, for example. They have accessible free meetings that a person can go to. They can visit face-to-face or by phone. And the meetings are there every day, and they're free. So even somebody who couldn't afford to get counseling or treatment, they could get help in a 12-step program.
Now, you are, in addition to being a counselor as far as food goes, you're also a family therapist and a marriage counselor. Does this issue of food, does this cause problems in families, food? And is that
most
why
certainly.
Sometimes, okay, could you explain that, please?
Well, there's a number of things. First of all, the person who's struggling usually is hiding their problem and they're ashamed. And the worse that it gets, the more ashamed that they are. So they will pull away. There's a sense of oftentimes isolation. And there also a lot of times I'll hear people just really complaining that they're just really not able to be there for their family because they're so messed up from what they're doing, whether they binged and now they feel guilty and now they feel fat and sick. And so they don't really feel like taking care of their kids and they're more irritable. And, you know, things just stress them out more. I think I mentioned before that a lot of times sex goes out the window because body image issues, you know, feeling fat, feeling sick, and so not wanting to be seen, not wanting to be naked in front of their spouse. Then, you know, you also have that, you know, not knowing, you know, using food to cope with conflict or to hide from challenges. And so, and then you have with the obesity issue, the whole matter of just not even being able to get around. So if you have a family, and I think of one of my clients who had two kids and his wife, and they were complaining that he couldn't keep up with them when they wanted to go on a day trip and they wanted to do activities, and he couldn't. He gets out of breath, he doesn't feel good, he can't keep up. And so it kind of puts a damper on family life in a lot of different ways.
I've read issues also where the child, again, getting back to the child, they may be obese and they have scars, not from school, but from their mother or father who yell at them and say, you are so fat, you are this, you are that. It really leaves a scar on the child because they're saying, this is my mom and dad.
Oh, yeah. And then what about when they're also trying to control them? And then, you know, they're so unhappy with what their child looks like that they're now, you know, watching what they're eating and making comments on what they're doing. And the kid just becomes more and more angry. I mean, I've a lot of stories of they can see the disgust on their parents' face. And it just ruins their self-esteem. And to try to recover from that, it's horrible. When a little girl, her father looks at her and just says, I mean, you'd be pretty if you would just lose some weight or, you know, these kinds of things. I mean, those scars are really hard to heal from.
And why is it, and it's not just for weight, it's also for age, that it's okay for a man to have his pot belly. But if a woman gains weight, then it's just like, I don't want a fat wife or I don't want a fat girlfriend.
Yeah, that's a little messed up.
It is.
I do wonder about that myself. And it is interesting, too, that very same guy with the pot belly is the one who's, you know, making his wife feel badly for her weight. And here he has, you know, his own weight problem. And I've seen it. It's just amazing to me the denial that person has, that you know, they're objectifying their wife. I suppose in some ways you're supposed to, it's all about looks because, you know, I want you to look good, but they can't be understanding about how hard it is to get the eating under control. And they're a part of the problem. You know, they're part of bringing the food around and taking them out to the restaurants with the junk food. And then they're mad that their wife doesn't look good. It's really confusing that we have that. It's a strange thing, but it's very common.
Do you have a website that people can go to, Rona, in case they have questions that perhaps we didn't answer?
I do, actually. I think the easiest way is to go to foodtriggersbook.com or else ronaepstein.com, either way. My name's a little harder to spell. That's why I say foodtriggersbook.com might be easier to know how to spell.
And do you have a Facebook page?
I do. I have an author page. And so I'll spell my name. It's RHONAEPSTEIN. And there's an author, Rona Epstein author, and that would be my page where I put information about food addiction and recovery.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rona, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today. We have been visiting with Dr. Rona Epstein. She is the author of the book Food Triggers, End Your Cravings and Eat Well and Live Better. And you can find out more about the book and about Rona by going to foodtriggersbook.com. And you can buy the book. You can find more answers to what Rona has been talking about. The book is published by Worthy Publishers, so you can also go to the publishing company and find out more about that. Dr. Epstein, again, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much. It was really my pleasure to share this time with you.
If you're curious about a book author or a book that you've seen lately and you'd like Louis Signs to pursue the author or the book on the prospective summer book club, why not email us? Come to ktep.org and click on the Contact Us button and leave a note for Louis Signs and make sure that it goes to Perspectives.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.